It's Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. In assessing the career of his colleague in the Senate, Matt Smith, State Senator Jay Costa of Forest Hills said Smith, quote, has served as a thoughtful and distinguished member of the Senate Democratic Caucus and was an advocate for hardworking people all across Allegheny and Washington counties, end quote. But now Matt Smith is taking his talents to Pittsburgh, where he's taking over as the head of the Greater Pittsburgh Chamber of Commerce. So how much will his experience in the state legislature help in his new job? He joins us for another in our series of what we call exit interviews. Matt Smith, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Great to be with you.
You can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is essspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at essspgh. Let's begin by looking at the news from this morning. You were a member of the Basic Education Funding Commission from the beginning, and today they made their recommendations, including a sweeping overhaul of Pennsylvania's funding formula for education that would take greater account of factors such as poverty and non-English-speaking students in an effort to close what it called the nation's worst spending gap between wealthier and poor districts. Do they address your concerns about equitable funding?
Well, I haven't seen the specific report at this point. I stepped down from the commission a couple weeks ago, but as you said, Paul, I did participate over the course of a year in our hearings, in our outreach to the various stakeholders involved on this issue. And I think the really encouraging thing is that it was passed unanimously with a bipartisan vote. Members of the commission on the Republican side, on the Democratic side, from the administration, all agreed with the contents of the report. And I think, you know, there was tremendous agreement and consensus around the issue of finding a way to create a fair, equitable funding distribution formula from Harrisburg. We're one of very few states, one of only a handful of states that right now does not have a dedicated funding formula, transparent funding formula for how education dollars will be distributed from Harrisburg. So I think the really encouraging thing is it's a sign that Republicans and Democrats can come together around a specific issue, around a big issue like education, work together over the course of a year and produce a product that does have bipartisan consensus and support.
And you've been in Harrisburg a long time. Do you think that they'll follow up on their recommendations?
Yeah, I do. I think there's a real commitment to make sure that after hearing from superintendents far and wide, from the southeast to the northeast to the northwest to the southwest, about the importance of a dedicated funding formula that is transparent and equitable across all 500 school districts in Pennsylvania, I really think there is, at a minimum, there certainly is support for it. There certainly is the goodwill and the intensity behind the issue that I think is necessary to try to get something done on it.
I'm sure your time in the state House and Senate must have brought its share of frustration, and this may have been one of those issues. The Democrats are the minority party in both houses of the legislature. Pundits talk about gridlock in Washington. Does it exist to some extent in Harrisburg?
Yeah, my experience has been actually very encouraging, that there are opportunities to work together, both in my experience in 6 years in the state house and then my experience in the state senate. And particularly over the last couple of years, we've been able to work in very much a bipartisan way in the legislature on a few big issues. Namely, the biggest issue that we worked on over the last couple of years is the transportation investment bill that we were able to get through, and Governor Corbett signed Act 89. As it's known right now, will provide significant investment for our roads, for our bridges, for our mass transit here in western Pennsylvania and throughout the Commonwealth. That was an issue where Democrats and Republicans got together and were able to craft a solution to our transportation infrastructure problem. And so I think, there are issues out there, education being one of them, transportation another, where I think it's so vital to work in a bipartisan way. And it's really something that I think the public wants us to be engaged, in terms of working together and working to develop solutions to these problems that we face.
Yeah, and you served, as you mentioned, on the Transportation Committee. Political leaders are still trying to figure out what Pittsburgh's transportation future should look like. We certainly have our share of, you know, there's the metaphorical gridlock, and then there's the actual gridlock that people driving home or to and from work in this town experience. And there have been various possible solutions to that problem that have been floated around. What do you think Pittsburgh's transportation future will look like? And what will you be doing as now the head of the Chamber of Commerce to lobby Harrisburg or talk to others to make that happen?
Yeah, one of the great things about this platform is the opportunity to work both with the private sector as well as the public sector in crafting solutions to issues like transportation, like our transportation problems that we have, not just in Western Pennsylvania, not just in the Commonwealth, but all throughout the United States. And I think there are several ways that it can be done. One that we tackled, as I said, over the last couple of years is passage of Act 89 in a bipartisan way. That provides funding to address fixing our roads. It provides funding to address fixing our bridges. We have the highest number of structurally deficient bridges in the United States. That funding package will go a long way towards fixing our bridges. And the third leg of that stool is investing in our public transportation systems, like the Port Authority here in Allegheny County and other transit systems in Western Pennsylvania. So that's, I think, the first step in making sure that we provide the funding, making sure we provide the resources to local governments to fix their roads and do what they need to do, to make sure the infrastructure is in place. I think there are various proposals out there. There's a very exciting law that we passed over the last couple of years, allowing three P3s, public-private partnerships, to form to address some of these transportation issues. That's another way that we can go about solving transportation. The really exciting thing about operating from the platform of the Allegheny Conference in the Chamber is being able to advocate for the region. And much of our regional success, has been over the last couple of years as a result of working together in a bipartisan way and doing things like the transportation bill, where we can provide the necessary transportation infrastructure so that when businesses are looking to relocate, we in Western Pennsylvania will have a leg up because we do have a robust transportation system in place.
And you represent Mount Lebanon. Mm-hmm. Years ago, people were trying to figure out what's a better way to get from the South Hills to downtown, and they built the light rail. What about, as we look at that very congested corridor going from downtown to Oakland and east, people have talked about bus rapid transit. It seems like it would be difficult to do now, but the possibility of more, subway or light rail. What do you think is the answer to that?
Well, I think, one of the things we need to do is look at it in a multifaceted way. I'm not sure there is one particular silver bullet as it relates to solving transportation issues or adding connectivity is really the way to look at it. I look at it as being able to make sure that we're drawing in the tremendous economic development engines that we have in Oakland, for instance, the University of Pittsburgh, CMU, into our downtown region and then out to the airport. And we've got to look at, possibly bus rapid transit as a solution, and various other solutions that might be out there to address that issue. But it's really about, making sure that we're connecting the various economic engines and neighborhoods in Allegheny County and Western Pennsylvania in a way that they're not right now, and we need to make sure that we're working on that.
It's the Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking with State Senator Matt Smith, who is taking over as head of the Greater Pittsburgh Chamber of Commerce. If you have a comment or question, you can call us at 412-246-2002. That is the number to call. You spent the last decade in the legislature. What led you to decide to switch jobs at this stage in your political career?
Yeah, I really look at public service as something that can come in many forms. And this was a unique opportunity to shape our state agenda, our regional agenda, our federal agenda from a key, robust regional platform that the Greater Pittsburgh Chamber of Commerce and the Allegheny Conference provides. And I saw firsthand the wonderful wonderful work that the conference and the chamber did over the last few years, and you know, really look at it as a unique opportunity to take the skills that I've developed over the last 8.5 years in the legislature and use them to advance our regional agenda and use them from this platform in a way that's certainly different than what I've done over the last 8.5 years, but in many ways is a continuation of that public service for the region.
You were in the Pennsylvania Senate. You've been in there since 2012. Before that, you served 6 years with the House. During your time in office, what accomplishments are you most proud of?
Yeah, as I mentioned, you know, I think the thing that I'm most proud of is developing, I think the reputation that I worked very hard at in working across the aisle and working in a bipartisan way to address problems and to find solutions to those problems. So on issues like Act 89, the Transportation Investment Bill, working on issues to further enhance our region for the potential Shell plant in Beaver County. I supported the legislation that passed in a bipartisan manner that Governor Corbett took the lead on back in the summer of 2012 to make sure that we have the right economic environment in place here in western Pennsylvania for a major economic development project like the Shell cracker. You know, those are the issues on the economic side. I'm also very proud to have worked on Rocco's Law. And as everyone knows, canine officer Rocco was killed in the line of duty about a year and a half ago at this point. We worked very quickly in a bipartisan way. We got all of the Allegheny County senators from Senator Acosta, Senator Furlow, Senator Fontana and Brewster on the Democratic side, Senator Volokovich on the Republican side, as joint prime sponsors of Rocco's Law, which added increased penalties for the torture or killing of a canine officer. And we worked on that very quickly. It's another example of something that can happen very quickly if we work in a bipartisan way to get something done. And we were able to get Rocco's Law done in about 4 months from initial introduction in the Senate to Governor Corbett's desk in that span. So I think, you know, it's another indication of something that when you build consensus, when you work diligently to build that support across the aisle, you know, things can happen in a very positive manner.
In your time in the state legislature, you served under Governors Ed Rendell and Tom Corbett and the current governor now, Tom Wolf. How would you describe the changes that different governors bring to the climate of the House and the Senate?
Yeah, it is very different. And I think that, you know, administrations are reflective of that particular governor's personality and as any executive is going to do to an organization that they're in the lead of. So, you know, some governors are you certainly believe, obviously, in one direction, others in the other direction. Some do more outreach than others. So it really depends on their frame of reference, on what brought them to that particular job. And I think it's, you know, anyone who's moving into a new role, whether it be assuming, you know, the position of governor of the Commonwealth or moving into a position like I am, brings with them their frame of reference, brings with them the skills that they've been able to develop, in their prior work experience, in their educational experience. And that's something I'm really excited to do as I transition into a new role.
Yeah, we began this conversation talking about the recommendations that came out today from the Basic Education Funding Commission. And, you know, the whole issue of the funding formula and some of the frustrations that you and perhaps some others might have felt about, you know, trying to get this done. Tom Wolf seemed to indicate right from the get-go that this was a priority of his. Does he deserve some credit for getting this moving?
Yeah, I think he does. The formula is something that you know, I think is, I would view as more of a consensus-driven idea. And it's something that, you know, our commission was co-chaired by Senator Pat Brown, a Republican state senator from Allentown, and State Representative Mike Varab, who is a state representative Republican from Montgomery County. And I think one of the things that I saw very early on in the commission, and this, you know, I think is something that Senator Brown and Representative Varab deserve a lot of credit for, they were very inclusive in the process. And we were able through that process over the course of a year and a couple months to hold hearings throughout the state. And they were very, one of the things I learned through that process in terms of the benefit, I guess, of being inclusive is they were able to hear from different perspectives. And I'll give you two examples. We were fortunate enough to have the commission in Allegheny County twice. We had them in October, hosted them in October of 2013 for a hearing out at CCAC West Hills campus, where I was able to bring a few superintendents from my Senate district to talk about their unique perspectives, their unique needs. And one of the things that I learned through the commission process was every school district, it does have unique needs and does have unique perspectives. So we heard from superintendents of Avonworth, Upper St. Clair. We received written testimony from South Fayette superintendent. And, that was something that I think was very valuable for all of the commissions to hear. Then we had the commission back out earlier this year, and we were able to hear specifically on the City of Pittsburgh School District issue. So we had Dr. Linda Lane testify. We had Ira Weiss, the city solicitor, testify. And I think really importantly, we had Mayor Peduto testify as to his thoughts on education, the funding formula, the importance of the City of Pittsburgh School District to his agenda in increasing the attractiveness to live and work and raise a family in Pittsburgh. And so I think that perspective was also very important for commission members to hear. And I think, as I said, to Senator Brown and Representative Verib's credit, I think they took a lot of those thoughts and crafted the product, which, as we saw today, ended in a bipartisan unanimous vote.
Economically, Pittsburgh has a lot going for it these days. What do you see as you get set to take over the Chamber of Commerce as the areas where the city could be doing better?
Yeah, I think it's not so much, I think, a matter of the city doing better, but I would look at it as continuing to build on the success that we've had both as a city and as a region. And I think there are a few things that we as an organization at the conference and the chamber look at. I think when you talk about the agenda, people is certainly one thing. Talent attraction and retention, making sure that we're aligning the workforce that we have here in Western Pennsylvania with the demands of employers, and not only making sure that we have individuals trained to fill those positions, but that we have the local education system in place. CCAC, our building trades, career and technical schools, that we have all of those organizations in line with what employers are looking for. There's been a lot of great work done over the last couple of years. That would certainly be an area that I would look to build upon in my role, and something that I think is critical when we talk about our future success, not just in the next 5 to 10 years, let's say, but in the next 15, 20, 25 years. And I think continuing to build on the idea that we're preparing our workforce for the jobs of today. And at the same time, we're preparing the workforce for the jobs of tomorrow. And I think that's something that we've got to look at. You talk about another thing, economy and community, being able to build on the success we've had in local communities with success. And we've got to make sure that we're looking at leveraging the existing assets that we have here in Western Pennsylvania, CMU and the University of Pittsburgh, and the collaboration that they've developed with UPMC on health information technology. That's a very exciting prospect for the region. And I think the third big thing, if I had to pick three, would be focusing on infrastructure and making sure, again, not just transportation infrastructure, which we've spent a lot of time discussing and I think is critically important to our success as a region, but building on the work that's been done on storm and sewer infrastructure. We have a big challenge coming up with implementation of the consent decree. I think that kind of infrastructure is very important. I also think infrastructure as it relates to broadband connectivity, making sure that we take advantage of the wonderful resources that we have at CMU and Google and all of the exciting, innovative aspects to our economy now in Western Pennsylvania. How can we leverage that to make sure that every community in Western Pennsylvania is connected by broadband and connected on the IT side of things? So when I look at infrastructure, I think of all the traditional forms of infrastructure that I think one would. And also building on that, the new forms of infrastructure. And as I said, IT, broadband, all of those things are I think, just as important in future economic success.
I think I have just one question left for you, which is, what will you miss most about being in the state legislature?
You know, I've thought about that a lot. I think the one thing that I'll miss is, you develop so many relationships, and you develop relationships with your colleagues. And as I said, I really worked hard to develop relationships across the aisle in the Senate and the House. So I'll miss those relationships, and certainly miss the relationships that I've developed with my staff, both in the district office and in Harrisburg. That's something that I take very seriously. I the work that my staff has done for me over the last 8.5 years has enabled me to achieve the legislative success that I've been able to have in a bipartisan way. And really, those relationships are always what's tough, I think, when you move from one chapter of your life to the next chapter.
And in some ways, this must seem like a natural progression, because you've built up these relationships, and now you can use those to your advantage as the head of the Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah, I think that's the way I look at it, certainly in both in Harrisburg and the relationships I've developed locally with our leaders here, Mayor Peduto, County Executive Fitzgerald, and all of the local elected officials in Western Pennsylvania. I'm very excited to continue working with those individuals and building success for the region.
State Senator Matt Smith is taking over as the head of the Greater Pittsburgh Chamber of Commerce and joined us to talk about that transition, looking back at his work in the legislature, looking ahead to what he'll be doing for the city of Pittsburgh. Senator Smith, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for being with us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Coming up, the Community Leadership Course for Veterans utilizes the skills and experience of post-9/11 veterans for improving the Pittsburgh region. It's now getting national attention. We'll find out why. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The Community Leadership Course for Veterans, CLCV, is an initiative created by Leadership Pittsburgh in 2014. Aimed at utilizing the skills of post-9/11 veterans, the CLCV has garnered national attention and is being honored with a national award. Here to tell us more about the CLCV are Aradhana Oliphant, President and CEO of Leadership Pittsburgh, and Benjamin Stahl, a graduate of the inaugural cohort of the Community Leadership Course for Veterans. He is currently working for the Veterans Leadership Program of Western Pennsylvania as Accreditation and Compliance Manager. Aradhana, Ben, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you for having us, Paul.
In the interest of full disclosure, last year, WESA partnered with Leadership Pittsburgh on Project 412, where veterans told their stories. Since then, what has been the reaction to the overall Community Leadership Course for Veterans? Aradhana, I'll let you start.
Thank you, Paul. Overwhelming. In fact, the community of civilians and veterans have come back to us and said, what can they do to help perpetuate this offering from Leadership Pittsburgh? And so we have been blown away. We have been working really hard to make sure that we have the processes in place that we can continue to offer this kind of a course. We've just launched the second cohort in April, and so the second cohort is underway.
And Ben, as far as you're concerned, what kind of reaction have you received? How gratifying has it been for you to get the kind of feedback you're getting?
What I could take out of CLCV, I believe it served its purpose as being a bridge between my experience in the military and my place in my community, my home, in my region, Pittsburgh. It's allowed me to continue to exercise my leadership abilities, my strengths, and the skill sets that I acquired in the military, and focus them on making my community better and our organizations better.
And what are your fellow veterans saying?
It's a very in-demand program. I think veterans are excited for the opportunity to be a part of Leadership Pittsburgh. It continues the camaraderie and the fraternity, the brotherhood and sisterhood that we experience in the military. So in that regards, it's a special program.
What aspects of the CLCV initiative seem to have resonated with people the most?
It is the connection with the community. And in Leadership Pittsburgh, Inc., and throughout the community leadership movement, we believe that you can't lead a community you don't love, and you cannot love a community that you don't know. So starting with that premise, if we have these wonderful veteran leaders who have served our country and have impeccable leadership skills, and now they are in our community, there are over 35,000 post-9/11 veterans in our region based on a Heinz Endowment and Hillman Foundation study. So how do we leverage their strengths towards the needs of our community? But why would they do it if they don't love the community? And how would they love the community if they don't get to know it? So that's what is special about CLCV. We get them interested in the community by sharing knowledge about the community, just like our other two selection-based programs. And we connect them with opportunities for service, which are in our leadership capacity, not just episodic volunteerism, though there's nothing wrong with episodic volunteerism. That's what CLCV does.
And Ben, has there at times been, as far as you're aware, a disconnect? You come home from your service, you've acquired certain skills, but you have no idea how to apply them in civilian life until somebody shows you how.
Absolutely. I don't think that in general the public is aware of the leadership capabilities of veterans. I think that once you take off your uniform, you're still that person. You're still that strong leader that you were in the military. And just because I'm a civilian, you know, living again in Pittsburgh, doesn't mean that I wasn't the strong leader that I was in the Navy. And I think that programs like CLCV help give us the confidence that the community sees us as those leaders, so we're able to continue serving in that capacity.
And can you give me some examples of how this has helped you take certain skills that you have and apply them in a way that, you know, really takes advantage of what you have to offer?
Absolutely. Well, one particular example would be the project we did with WESA, the Veteran Stories Project 412. WESA was gracious enough to let us operate kind of with autonomy and deliver the project with limited oversight. We were given leadership roles in that project, and we, as a team of veterans and as a members of the cohort of CLCV1, we exercised each other's unique strengths and leadership capabilities to deliver that project. Basically, we wanted to capture the stories of our region's veterans to let members of the community know that veterans and members of the military are your neighbors. They are your family. They're not just the guy in camouflage on a movie. It's not just a story. It's not just a paragraph in the history book. These are your neighbors. This is living history, and these people are living in your community. They're members of your community. So what we wanted to do was capture that story with a uniquely Pittsburgh flair. So we went out and we interviewed World War II veterans, all the way up to members of our own cohort, so from all conflicts across all eras. And the resounding message that we got from that was that we're all the same. We were all the same. We all had to have a passion for our community. We all care about, you know, humanity, and we're all connected by a common bond. And that's, you know, love for our country and a desire to continue to serve. That's something that's a common thread that we found from the Pacific conflicts in World War II and the Navy to, you know, guys that were back from Afghanistan for a couple months. So it was a unique experience to be able to speak to everyone in that capacity, to hear those stories.
Aradna, tell us about the national attention that this has been receiving and the award that you won.
So we were so humbled to have received the Innovation Award, the National Award for Innovation, from our peers. There are over 500 programs like ours or organizations like ours across the country, and we all belong to a national membership organization where we exchange best practices. And that organization, the Association of Leadership Programs, gives out an innovation award or two every year, every other year. So we submitted CLCV as an entry in for consideration for that award. And we were the only one picked. I mean, we were so I'm told that we were the only one picked because the innovation that we had exhibited in the community leadership field with this was so heads and shoulders above anything else that they received. So this is across the country, community leadership programs, looking at Pittsburgh to say you are leading in. You know, so we have developed some proprietary processes and materials that the board and I are considering. How do we really systematically, with an attention to quality, roll it out? So with the award will come more attention, but before the award is announced, it will be announced officially towards the middle of this month. Even before that, we, for example, Erie County locally, regionally is interested. Somerset County is interested. Lackawanna is interested. I got a call from the governor's office in Nevada, and they want to know about this program. I mean, so
wow.
So we think we are onto something here, and it's great to be counted amongst the innovations that seem to spring from this region. We have something in the rivers here that we tend to be at the forefront of, whether it's air quality movements or green building movements. We just seem to be doing that in Pittsburgh. So that's the thing that gives us the biggest pride, to be able to showcase Pittsburgh's innovation to the country. And in the process, employ the great skill sets and leadership that our veterans have for the benefit of the community. And this is not a skills program. It's not a jobs program. It's they have the skills. They have the leadership. They are either studying, the people who apply to this CLCV, they are either getting a degree at a college locally or are in jobs like Ben works for the Veterans Leadership Program, which is a nonprofit organization serving veterans. And so when he applied to the program, he was not looking for skills. He was looking for that connectivity with the region and with a cohort of peers, others who have also served our country. And that's, I think, what probably attracted him to apply for the program. He was selected, and then he went through a six-month-long program, which had this project component that he was talking about. We believed and are even more sure after our first cohort that they have the leadership. What we need our communities to look at is, how do we deploy those leadership skills?
It's the Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and I'm talking with Aradhana Oliphant, President and CEO of Leadership Pittsburgh, and Benjamin Stahl, a graduate of the inaugural cohort of the Community Leadership Course for Veterans, and he is currently working for the Veterans Leadership Program of Western Pennsylvania as Accreditation and Compliance Manager. As the second year of the Community Leadership Course for Veterans gets underway, have you made any changes to the program?
Yes. You know, as well-received as the first cohort was, I mean, over 94% of CLCV1 graduates said that it motivated them to become even more engaged in the community. We placed over 90% of them on area nonprofit boards. So that's the difference. It's the leadership in the community, and 100% of them said they expanded their networks, etc. Despite that kind of a response, at Leadership Pittsburgh, Inc., we are a little crazy. We don't just sit on our laurels. We like to say, okay, how can we improve? What better, differently can we do next year? So we solicited the help of people like Ben and Jim Yager and Sean Ray and Sean Rohrer. These are graduates of our CLCV1 cohort, and said, tell us, be totally critical. Tell us what could we improve. And with that, for example, we were having sessions every week. They said to us, every week is great, but what if you gave a gap? They also said, but don't extend it to beyond 6 to 7 months. There was a session where we had their significant other also come in for kind of networking, just some content thrown in, but some networking so that they could get to know each other's families a little bit. They said, for example, that was good, but Leadership Pittsburgh doesn't have to organize that. The classmates themselves can organize that. So that's how you can find some time, take away that session. You don't have to do that. They reaffirmed for us that it's important to include as project hosts, like WESA was a project host. They ended up working on a veteran story, but you're not a veterans organization. So CLCV1 graduates said to us, that's good. We love the veterans. We want to serve the veterans, but the veterans community, we kind of sort of know. So host agencies should be non-veterans. Mm. And that was beautiful for us because that's what we have thought, but we were not sure. So they affirmed that. What it does is also, it says to WESA, it exposes an WESA or a Boys and Girls Club, which was another host agency. Goodwill is one of the agencies this year. Quantum Theater is one of the agencies this year. Councilwoman Natalia Rudiak's office is one of the host agencies this year. It exposes those community-based agencies to the tremendous assets that veterans are, so that the community's image, our hope is that community's framework for looking at veterans is not just, oh, how can we help them? Rather, how can they help us, and how are they helping us?
For Ben, that's got to be a refreshing way of looking at it.
Absolutely. I know for a fact that there are veterans who need our help, but they're not necessarily looking for a handout. They're looking for a hand up. Resources to continue to exercise with the strength and the honor and the dignity that they served with. And for me, I'm at the forefront of trying to break down that stereotype of the broken, wounded veteran who has nothing to contribute back to society. Quite the contrary. We're strong, very capable members of society who are actively willing to contribute back in some capacity. And if you show us the door, we'll open the door.
One last question. For veterans listening to this interview who aren't aware of this initiative, how can they take part if they are interested?
They can go on our website at www.lpinc-clcv.org or just Google Community Leadership Course for Veterans and it'll direct you to something. The next cohort will be selected for beginning April of 2016 because it is only one cohort that we run every year. So applications should be online in a couple of months. They can apply and go through the selection process. It is meant for the high potential veterans.
We've been talking about the Community Leadership Course for Veterans with Aradhana Oliphant, President and CEO of Leadership Pittsburgh, and Benjamin Stahl, a graduate of the inaugural cohort of the Community Leadership Course for Veterans. Thank you both for being with us on Essential Pittsburgh. We appreciate it.
Delighted to be here.
Thank you, Paul.
And more Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Now that summer's here, one of the best places to go and explore the great outdoors is a national park. There are so many to explore throughout the United States. Time does not permit us to cover all of them. However, today we'll get an overview of parks with Elaine LaBalme, who tweets about food and travel under the Twitter handle New Girl in Town. Hello, Elaine.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. It's summer. You have your wingman with you, your son, Steven.
I do. Steve-o
is
here.
He's out of school. That tells us that the vacation season is upon us. So, New Girl, you're sending us out to explore national parks this summer. Why national parks when Pennsylvania has an award-winning state park system of its own?
Well, you know, that is a perfectly good question. And Pennsylvania does have some terrific parks. I believe it's 121 state parks, and they're great. They've got something for everyone. To me, though, the national parks, they are iconic. There are just so many, you know, they've been made national parks for a reason. They tend to have the unique features that you will only find there. A lot of people have national parks on their bucket list. You know, so as well, a lot of them are really good in the summer. You shouldn't be dissuaded by the fact that, you know, you think there's going to be crowds. You're not going to get to what you want to see. I mean, if you're thinking about, you know, when will the waterfalls in a lot of these parks be the fullest? You know, when will the hiking trails be the driest? When will the temperatures be, you know, most welcoming for overnight camping and things of that nature?
When will there be less bugs? You know?
Probably right now, Paul. Maybe not so much in August. No, I hear you. You know, maybe everything won't be perfect in the summer. But believe me, there, you know, for a variety of reasons, kids in school, weather, what have you, you're not going to get to a lot of these places in the fall and winter. The summer is the time to go. And, you know, a number of the parks have spruced up this year, some of the iconic parks especially. So it's a good time to visit and to put them on the list.
All right, let's talk about some specific parks. Great Smoky Mountains National Park is a day's drive from here and is now apparently more welcoming than ever.
Well, you know, when I say a day's drive, I guess you have to – I'm talking about
You're talking about an Elaine day?
The Elaine day, right? The Elaine LaBalle method of travel and driving. And that is that we really love road trips. And, you know, for us to drive 8 hours, 10 hours – to get someplace is not a big deal.
But that is a Midwestern mindset. Okay, in the East, you know, driving that distance is like that's you know, pack a survival kit. And that's you know what I mean.
But
other parts of the country, in what they call flyover country,
right.
People think nothing of that. So well, you're of that frame.
Well, yeah,
of
sure.
Mind.
All those years in California, and it's a very big state, and you know, people will drive from San Francisco to L.A. because you know. Because you can, or wherever you want to go. The distances are long. You're just used to it. The beauty of doing it here is that the distances are so short. I believe you want to embrace it. I do believe that Great Smoky Mountain National Park is just about an 8 or 9 hour drive. You know, get up at sunrise. You know, embrace it. Hit the road. You're there by mid-afternoon in any event.
How fast are you driving?
Well, we're driving at the speed limit. And in many states, Paul, not Pennsylvania, it is 70.
So you get up. All right, I'm doing the math here. So you'd have to get up at 4 in the morning there by noon.
Paul, what I'm saying is you get up at 6 or 7 a.m., you get there by 4.
Oh, I see. Okay.
We could be a little more civilized. Okay. And you know what? You're there in time to crack a beer and set up the campground.
Now
right?
You're talking.
There you go. But the reason I like this park, this is one of my favorite parks anyway, but their most popular trail is called Chimney Tops. This is a trail. It's 1.9 miles out, and then, you know, the loop is a little under 4 miles, but it's super, super steep. The last, I think, mile, it's a 960-foot elevation. It's not for everyone, but when you get to the top, the views, I mean, absolutely amazing. The neat thing about Chimney Tops is that it's been redone by hand using organic materials. So people laid in hundreds of new stones, super heavy, 200, 300-pound stones on the trail. The log, you know, steps, retaining walls, drainage ditches.
That's a little easier to climb.
Easier to climb now. A trail that is a stunner, but a challenge for many, has now been made easier. It just debuted the renovation. Get there now and just enjoy it and embrace it. The fact that at an iconic trail is now so much better, to me, is the best reason to visit this park this year. Go check it out. I'd love to hear reports.
And then Shenandoah National Park in Virginia is close by and is looking for greater engagement with kids.
Indeed. And okay, so this one is really close. It's just 75 miles south of Washington, D.C. So here you're talking a 4 or 5 hour drive. You can get up at 7 a.m. and be there by noon in time for lunch. Trail, they have a really neat trail called the Black Rock Trail. It's now officially been designated what's known as a Kids in Parks Track Trail. And what they're doing around the national parks is they're setting aside certain trails and trying to engage kids more. So geocaching, other explorations. They have a self-guided map that you can bring with you on the trail. In the case of this particular trail, it talks a lot about the Appalachian Trail, of which it is part. So you can then combine your experience on the trail with an online app, of course. Steve-O will probably hike trails with me this summer with his phone in his hand. And you can then track your progress and even win prizes. And this really calls to mind a trip that Steve-O and I took to Williamsburg several years ago at Williamsburg, Virginia, the you know historic colonial village.
Sure.
And they had a number of explorations you could do there that were interactive and that allowed kids to, you know, almost like a scavenger hunt, as it were, and follow along on your personal device and whatnot. And I brought Steve-O and a friend of his, and they were so, believe me, the 3 days we were there, this was the most engaging experience that they had because it was at their level, Paul. It involved technology. It was participatory. It kept them interested. So I'm really loving this Kids in Parks Track Trail system and the fact that one so close to home, Shenandoah National Park, is part of it is a reason to go there this summer.
And what you're saying brings to mind an interesting question, and I get what you're saying about technology, and sure, that's what a lot of kids want. It's what keeps them engaged. But isn't part of the purpose of going out into nature like this to get away? Well, really, at some point, how do we unplug? Should we unplug?
Yeah, well, like you, I'm reading those stories of people who are being challenged to not use an electronic device for 24 hours, whether it's adults or teenagers. They simply cannot do it.
Your son is over there frowning right now.
He probably does not want to be away from Instagram for 24 hours. You know what I'm saying, Paul? I think what I'm saying is this.
Look at him.
I know.
The very thought of it, I can't handle it.
And if we can get outdoors and he is able to be more interested in doing some of these things, mm-hmm. because they can meet him at his level somewhat, you know what? Meet him halfway. There you go.
Okay. We're talking with Elaine LaBaume. She is our travel correspondent and talking about places that you can go this summer if you want to explore national parks. And that granddaddy of national parks, Yellowstone, will also be more welcoming later this summer.
Yeah, they've done something really neat. And I've been to Yellowstone a couple times. And the challenge there can be lodging. It's a very popular park. I think next to Yosemite, probably the most popular park in terms of visitors in the national park system. So they've redone some of their iconic cabins. The Canyon Lodges, three of the five lodges have been completely redone. They've replaced several hundred outdated cabins. As well, they're doing a major renovation of the Lake Yellowstone Hotel, this fantastic property. That one will be ready in June. So while lodging can be tough to come by, especially in this park, what I would encourage people to do is to see now if they can get in. If they can't, have a plan B, so a different campground or perhaps a hotel nearby. But continue to call to see if you can get a cancellation and get into one of these cabins or the Lake Yellowstone Hotel. And it called to mind for me a trip years ago to the Grand Canyon, and I really wanted to stay at the El Tovar Hotel, which is right on the South Rim. It was sold out, had been for months. Some folks encouraged me, just see if you can get a last-minute cancellation. 2-3 weeks leading up to the trip, I kept calling. Long short is the week before, I got a cancellation.
Boom.
And I got to stay at the El Tovar, and it's the only time I've stayed there. So keep the faith. You could get a cancellation or get on a waiting list, and you may get to stay at one of these iconic properties, which really enhances the experience.
And even though Yellowstone is so iconic, Yosemite National Park is your favorite.
Oh.
And it has new offerings that you'll be checking out in August?
Yeah, we are going to be there back in California in August for an extended trip, catching up with friends and whatnot. But the Tioga Road, which is the main road leading into the park, has been renovated, rehabbed, improved. And believe me, it needed it. So your trip into the park will now be a lot easier. As well, they have introduced this spring a herd of Sierra Nevada bighorn sheep into Yosemite that hadn't been there for many years. So that would be something neat to see. I don't recall seeing bighorn sheep in Yosemite ever. And the Yosemite Theater, which is a terrific facility in the valley, has been relaunched with some new programming. And the actor Lee Stetson, who has played John Muir in a variety of settings, will be, John Muir being the father of the national park system, basically, will be portraying him in a series of programs throughout the summer. But the other thing that you have to keep in mind with Yosemite this year is that because of the drought in the West, the waterfalls may not be as full, but I can almost assure you that that will keep the crowds down. A lot of people go to Yosemite just when the waterfalls are full.
Mm. Now, we have about less than a minute to talk about Acadia National Park in Maine. Still on your list, certainly worth a visit.
This is a park that I have not been to, but again, they also have some new campgrounds that have launched this year. This is a park that is on the very rugged Atlantic coast, largely around Mount Desert Island. Great hiking there. If you want something a little less strenuous, something that they do really beautifully there, they have this 45-mile system of stone carriage roads that was built by John D. Rockefeller Jr. for his horse-drawn vehicles. Charming, eh? But apparently that's a wonderful way to experience Acadia if you're not interested in hiking. And the hiking is pretty good there, from what I understand. That one is on my bucket list, and I won't get there this summer, but hopefully next
well,
summer.
Well, yeah, it sounds like you've got enough on your plate.
We're busy.
Elaine LaBaume, our travel contributor, thank you so much. When you came in, it was raining. You've brought the sunshine with you.
Aww.
And thank you so much.
You bet.
Tomorrow on Essential Pittsburgh, we'll learn more about the latest challenge for endurance swimmer Darren Miller, and NASA celebrates the Martian New Year in Mars, Pennsylvania. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.